So if these are the winners, then problems are going to continue to mount in the Middle East.
The next round of UN-sponsored Geneva peace talks is scheduled to get underway November 28. In Saudi Arabia, members of the opposition reportedly will demand Mr. Assad's ouster in any post-war transition. Ousted Zimbabwe Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa is back in the country, preparing to be sworn in as president, following Tuesday's resignation of longtime ruler Robert Mugabe. He addressed thousands of supporters.
The people have spoken. You yourself said, if the people say I must step down, you shall comply. This is the time to comply.
Mnangagwa said, we are witnessing the beginning of a new and unfolding democracy. His dismissal 2 weeks ago triggered a military takeover, leading to Mr. Mugabe's resignation. This is VOA News. 22 years after the worst post-war European atrocity, the UN Yugoslav War Crimes Tribunal ruled Wednesday that former Bosnian Serb Army leader Ratko Mladic was guilty of genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. They referred to the massacre of thousands of Muslim men and boys in Srebrenica, as well as the siege of Sarajevo. Mladic was sentenced to life in prison. He had to be removed from the courtroom in The Hague for angrily shouting rejection of the proceedings. Darko Mladic, his son, spoke for his father.
He said, this is all a lie. This is not a court. This is a NATO commission. And that they are trying to criminalize legal endeavor of Serbian people in some times of civil war to protect itself from the aggression.
UN Human Rights Chief Zayed Raad al-Hussein praised the court's decision as a momentous victory for justice. The U.S. called on the people in the Balkans to work together for a better future. The Argentine Navy acknowledged Wednesday the week-long search for a submarine in the South Atlantic has reached a critical phase, as the crew of 44 will likely be running out of oxygen. Navy spokesman Enrique Balbi said the matter of oxygen is a critical situation and the concern is rising. Dozens of planes and ships from several countries, including the U.S., are involved in a search and rescue effort for the ARA San Juan. The Saudi-led coalition fighting Houthi rebels in Yemen said it will reopen the country's main international airport and a vital Red Sea port to humanitarian traffic starting Thursday. Jamie McGoldrick is the UN resident coordinator for Yemen.
We're asking the Saudis to open the port of Hodeida and Salif that allows us to bring in the humanitarian cargo we need to feed people and to medically support them in that regard. We're also asking for the Sana'a airport to be opened for the humanitarian flights to allow vaccines to come in, but at the same time to allow humanitarian workers to come and go, both for the UN flights and the NGO flights.
The coalition closed Yemen's entry points earlier this month after a ballistic missile was fired from rebel-held territory. The closures were aimed at cutting off weapons shipments. Palestinian factions meeting in Cairo have agreed to hold elections by the end of next year, following October's reconciliation agreement between Hamas and Fatah. A date for voting will be left up to Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. A Pakistani court has ordered the release from house arrest of Hafiz Saeed, accused of masterminding attacks on the Indian financial capital Mumbai in 2008 that killed nearly 170 people. Saeed has repeatedly denied involvement in the attack. The U.S. has designated him a terrorist and offered a multi-million dollar bounty. On Wall Street Wednesday, trading was thin ahead of the two-day Thanksgiving holiday weekend. The benchmark Dow Jones average shedding nearly 65 points to close at 23,526. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 23rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Former Zimbabwe Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa is expected to be sworn in tomorrow, Friday, as president, but last night he thanked Zimbabweans for their support.
The people of Zimbabwe, you who are gathered here to receive me, may I say, I thank you for receiving me.
A Zimbabwean analyst says it's likely a transitional government might be formed to deal with the country's collapsing economy. Zambia's president reveals he did offer President Mugabe an asylum in Zambia. and a former Angola ambassador, once former President Eduardo dos Santos, prosecuted for crimes committed during his 38-year rule.
If we have to prosecute people in this country, then everybody who has been involved in governance since 1975, you know, everybody has to go through this process so that, you know, the process is fair and just.
Elias Isaac is a country director for the Open Society in Angola. A former U.S. ambassador to Liberia says she's disappointed by ongoing legal challenges to Liberia's October 10 presidential election results. And a new research says oil spills in Nigeria double the risk of infant mortality. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Former Zimbabwe Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa is expected to be sworn in tomorrow, Friday, as president. Mnangagwa returned to the country Wednesday after spending about 2 weeks in exile. His ascendance follows the resignation Tuesday of longtime President Robert Mugabe. Last night, Mr. Mnangagwa thanked Zimbabweans for their support and prayers during his ordeal, which he said included an attempt to assassinate him.
The people of Zimbabwe, you who are gathered here to receive me, may I say in the name of our Lord, I thank you for receiving me. Exactly 16 days ago, I received a letter firing me from government of the Republic of Zimbabwe as Vice President. Within 2 hours, I was informed about plans to eliminate me. Realizing that on the 12th of August this year, I was subjected to poisoning, which resulted in my being airlifted to South Africa. And again, I thank you, the people of Zimbabwe, for your prayers that I survived that poisoning. This time around, I say to myself, I should not wait for them to eliminate me, but let me go out and with you, the people of Zimbabwe, the people of ZANU-PF, make your voice be heard. Today, I feel so humbled that we have remained here until this hour at our headquarters, waiting for me, that you see me and I see you.
Mr. Mnangagwa also thanked the Zimbabwe Defense Forces under the leadership of General Christian Chiwenga for the smooth manner in which they handled the military intervention. He appealed to all patriotic Zimbabweans to come together to grow their country's crumbling economy.
I pledge myself to be your servant. I appeal to all genuine patriotic Zimbabweans to come together. We work together. No one is more important than the other. All Zimbabweans want to grow our economy. We want peace in our country. We want jobs for us to grow our economy.
Mr. Mnangagwa also appealed to the Southern African Development SADC countries, the African Union, and the international community for their cooperation in growing the Zimbabwe economy. A Zimbabwean working with civil society groups inside Zimbabwe says given the country's collapsed economy, it is most likely that ZANU-PF might introduce a constitutional amendment to make possible the formation of a transitional government with key members taken from opposition parties and civil society. Thabang Nari says although elections are scheduled for 2018 and that there are still some outstanding reforms to be made, the transition process should be more of a priority right now to rescue Zimbabwe from its current political and economic crisis.
From what we gather from sources back home, the Congress of ZANU-PF will take place in December. I think it's the second week of December where it's planned. And Mr. Mnangagwa will be confirmed by that Congress as the new president, and they call it the first secretary of ZANU-PF, and the future presidential candidate, I guess. But given the deep economic crisis that we have in Zimbabwe, the thinking is that his party, ZANU-PF, is likely to sponsor a constitutional amendment that will facilitate the setting up of a new inclusive government, a transitional government in Zimbabwe. So the feeling among some quarters is that while the elections are what was supposed to happen, the transition is more of a priority right now, and it will be better to rescue Zimbabwe economically and thereafter set in place the processes that will lead to an election. We know that there are outstanding electoral reforms that are needed. There was a voter registration process that was already currently underway, but if the truth must be told, the country is in an economic crisis, a political crisis, and it is likely that the compromise will be that before we deal with the political crisis.
You said transitional government. Is that going to be with the current opposition parties?
I think the idea is to pick key leaders of the opposition, maybe a few people from business, a working group that will basically work together to rescue Zimbabwe from the current economic quagmire.
In the meantime, what happens now to former President Mugabe? Is he under house arrest and is he going to remain in Zimbabwe?
So there's an inauguration ceremony planned for Friday. Mr. Mnangagwa in his speech said that regional leaders will be attending that inauguration ceremony. And I think it would work in Mr. Mnangagwa's favor if Mr. Mugabe attends that inauguration ceremony and is seen to be handing over power, transferring power from one of the founding fathers of the nation to the new generation, although he was really a compatriot of Mugabe, Mr. Mnangagwa. But I would suppose that after that handover ceremony has taken place, Mr. Mugabe might need to take a break, a holiday, maybe outside the country, so that there is no conflict of interest. You know, they've talked about one center of power to say in the transition there might be people who feel attached to Mr. Mugabe and are finding it difficult to let go of him as the president. So in that respect, it might be good for him to take a bit of a short break outside the country. I know he has always expressed this desire that he will die in Zimbabwe. But because of the power dynamics, currently, I think it would be good if he can find a base, whether it's in South Africa, Singapore, where he's got medical treatment in the past, so that the new regime takes over and can put in place whatever rescue package they would like to put in place.
Thabang Nari is a Zimbabwean living in the U.S. city of Dallas, Texas. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 23rd. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. A spokesman for Zambian President Edgar Lungu says the Zambian leader offered President Robert Mugabe asylum in Zambia during the standoff between the military and the 93-year-old Mugabe. Presidential spokesman Amos Chanda says Mr. Lungu made the offer last Friday in Luanda, Angola, during a meeting of the Southern African Development Community Defense and Security Committee. Chanda says President Lungu made the offer as part of a regional effort to facilitate a smooth transition in Zimbabwe, but he said President Mugabe turned down the offer.
President Lungu spoke to President Mugabe last Friday at the height of the uncertainty and tensions in Zimbabwe when the military commanders were pushing for him to step down and there were street protests and tensions were extremely high in Zimbabwean society. The president spoke to President Mugabe and said that in order to facilitate a smooth transition, Zambia was prepared to offer him asylum. President Mugabe flatly declined and said that he did not think that it would get to that point. And the president reassured him that should that need come about, then he should know that Zambia was always available for him to come to. The decision to offer him asylum was within the spirit of generally the regional leaders, what everyone wanted. I think that everyone was desirous of a quick and amicable settlement to the situation. That quick and amicable settlement was premised on the departure of President Mugabe.
By your president offering to harbor President Mugabe, your president was in reality condoning or supporting the military taking over of the country.
No, the president was supporting efforts towards a quick and amicable settlement. The military had intervened and gave a statement that that was not a military takeover of government. We gave them a benefit of that. That was not a military takeover because they continued to salute President Mugabe and they continued to remain loyal to him as their commander-in-chief. If government had been taken over by the military, then the resignation yesterday would not have been an issue. The fact that President Mugabe was resigning only yesterday convinces us that there was not a military coup in Zimbabwe. What the president was endorsing was the general view that a more inclusive Zimbabwe was possible, more likely without President Mugabe than him staying at the helm. So the president was simply proposing a win-win situation.
Amos, in what context would their president offer the former Zimbabwe leader a place in Zambia? Is it in the context of an African statesman or the relation your country had with President Mugabe when he was president of Zimbabwe?
The context in which he offered him asylum was if President Mugabe was president, as he was, as you know, on Friday when that offer was given, then President Lungu offers him asylum. You are simply asking him to vacate the seat of president. If he vacates the seat of president, then there will be a quicker and amicable settlement. So it was in the context of adding to efforts to resolve a potentially dangerous situation, because if you have 1.5 million people on the street and you have military tanks on the street, the president understood that probably Zimbabwe would be cooler, would be calmer and more open to everyone without President Mugabe, which is why on Friday, when President Mugabe was still president, an offer of asylum was given.
Thank you very much, Emma. So nice to talk with you.
All right. Thank you very much for this.
Emma Chanda is spokesman for Zambian President Edgar Lungu. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lusaka. The former Angolan ambassador to Tanzania has called for the prosecution of former President Eduardo Dos Santos for crimes committed under his 38-year rule. At a news conference in the capital, Luanda, Ambassador Ambrosio Lukoki accused the former president of hiding behind the leadership of the ruling MPLA party to prevent any possible prosecution. But MPLA supporters, the Ambassador Lukoki, is engaging in a publicity stunt, particularly when he himself was a prominent member of the ruling party during former President Dos Santos' rule. Elias Isaac, country director for the Open Society, tells viewers Peter Clotty that it will be difficult to prosecute the former president at the moment.
I think, you know, these suggestions are very, very serious and are very dangerous. Because if we have to prosecute people in this country, then everybody who has been involved in governance since 1975, you know, everybody has to go through this process so that, you know, the process is fair and just and not just pointing to one person. It's obviously, you know, the former President Dos Santos was the head of state, but he was not ruling alone. He's not the only one, you know, involved in direct abuse of human rights violation, police brutality and so on. As a member of the ruling party, he knows what he's talking about. And this should be dealt with within the ruling party. And it's very unfortunate that he's making public statements as such while he has the right forums for him to do so.
Some of his supporters are saying he's right to air them out because the Constitution guarantees him freedom of speech. But do you think people in MPLA share similar thoughts.
I believe that within the ruling party, there are people who have the same views, but, you know, they cannot express them openly. Because this has been the trend, you know, most of the politicians, while they're still serving in the political party ranks, you know, they don't speak out until they come out. This is very serious and very tricky. Even those people may have similar views within the ruling party, they'll not be able to speak out because, you know, they're bound by the party rules.
Based on the fact that the current president, Lourenco, is close with former president Dos Santos, do you think there's even a remote chance that he would make a move and have the legal structures prosecute former president Eduardo Dos Santos, like it's been suggested by Ambassador Lukoki?
You know, it will be very, very difficult. You know, there are very serious steps that President João Lourenco he has to take. And I believe that it's too soon for him to make any steps, you know, towards President Dos Santos. Because President Dos Santos currently is the president of the ruling party, and the President João Lourenco, the president of the state, is the vice president in the party. So that creates, you know, an ambiguity, you know, in terms of power, you know, sharing and how the country is being governed. So if that will happen, it's not going to happen today because President Dos Santos has been ruling this country for 38 years and he has created structures and systems that are still in place in which the new president, you know, is trying to build or to dismantle, you know, some of the pieces so that finds, you know, his own way to govern this country. So it will not happen soon.
Elias Isaac is the country director for the Open Society in Angola. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital, Luanda. The former U.S. ambassador to Liberia, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, has defended a statement put out earlier this month by the U.S. embassy in Liberia, expressing confidence in the integrity of the October 10th elections. In that statement, the embassy stressed the importance of a peaceful transfer of power to a democratically elected president in January next year, in line with Liberia's constitution. Some Liberians criticized the statement as an interference in the internal affairs of Liberia. Some even suggested that the embassy might have released the statement without the blessing of Washington. Ambassador Thomas Greenfield says U.S. embassies do not normally need Washington's approval to issue such statements. She also says she's disappointed by ongoing legal challenges to Liberia's October 10th presidential election results.
I saw Liberia go through 14 years of civil war. I participated in the election that elected Ellen Johnson Sirleaf in 2006, and it was an extraordinary experience watching the people of Liberia show that they didn't want to fight anymore and they were going to use their power of the vote. And so they did that again on October 10. 70% of them voted, and now their votes are being challenged. And I'm not saying the election was perfect. I think there were some issues, but none that changed the results of this election. So I'm hopeful that the Supreme Court and the National Election Commission will resolve this issue so that the people of Liberia can vote for their next president.
As I mentioned, you serve as an ambassador, but you're also a very dear friend of Liberia. You're a friend of President Sirleaf also. Now, people were complaining that one of the reasons for the challenge was that she interfered with the electoral process. What, do you have any comment on that?
You know, I've heard that. I do not believe the president interfered with the electoral process. Did she make mistakes? All leaders make mistakes, so it was probably not a good decision to meet with the magistrates, but I don't think that there was any intention to interfere with the electoral process. And if she did, we still had two top candidates that won. So what did she do that made those election results any different? And I just don't feel that way. And I know Liberians will say it's because we're friends. I'm friends with all Liberians.
So you said that whoever is elected president should be able to build on the legacy of President Sirleaf or maybe correct whatever error she may have made. What do you think is her legacy?
You know, I did an op-ed piece for allafrica.com, and I talked about her legacy of consolidating Liberia's peace, bringing respect to Liberia from the rest of the world, making Liberia a player internationally, and bringing development. There is a new turbine that I was there to cut the ribbon on in last year in December at Mount Coffee. So I think there are a lot of areas where Liberians can be proud of their president, and they need to be proud of her and move on and start building their own legacy.
I know you're no longer at the State Department and you're no longer the ambassador, but the U.S. Embassy issued a statement about the process that's taking place in Liberia. There was a question here today whether the embassy went rogue. Did they get any instructions from Washington to do that? And some people said no. What do you think?
We hire ambassadors because they're smart. We hire ambassadors because they're leaders. Ambassadors don't have to get approval to issue a statement locally. And so I'm very happy the embassy made the decision to issue that statement.
Finally, do you have any preference, either George Weah or Vice President Joseph Boakai?
I know both of them, and it's going to be the choice of the Liberian people, and whoever the people of Liberia elect as a friend of Liberia and a former ambassador, I will do everything in my power to ensure that that person is successful.
Ambassador, so nice to talk with you.
You as well, and my warm greetings to Liberia.
Thank you very much. Linda Thomas Greenfield is the former U.S. ambassador to Liberia. She spoke with me recently in Washington on the sidelines of a panel discussion about the Liberian elections. Babies are much more likely to die in their first few weeks of life if their mothers live close to the site of an oil spill, according to new research. Scientists studied data on infant mortality and oil spills in Nigeria's Niger Delta region and described their results as shocking. Henry Richwell reports.
It's estimated that 240,000 barrels of crude oil are spilled into the Niger Delta every year. The environmental effects are clear to see. The effect on the people is slowly coming to light. The study by scientists at Switzerland's University of St. Gallen is shocking. Babies born in the Delta are twice as likely to die in the first month of life if their mothers were living close to an oil spill before they became pregnant.
We looked at the birth histories of more than 2,500 Nigerian mothers, and we compared siblings, some conceived before and some conceived after a nearby oil spill.
The researchers compared geo-referenced data on 6,600 recent oil spills with results from the 2013 National Demographic and Health Survey. Their results show that even spills that happened 5 years before conception doubled the chances of babies dying after birth. However, spills that happened during pregnancy appear to have little effect.
We think the main reason is that some of the negative health effects, such as building up over time. So if you think about these negative health effects, these are due to skin contact with crude oil, or to drinking contaminated water, or eating contaminated fish or crops, and also inhaling smoke from fires.
It's thought unborn and newborn infants are more vulnerable as they haven't built up natural defenses. But the researchers say more clinical work is needed to determine how crude oil affects health. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
That's it for this Thursday, November 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a good Thursday.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Today is Thursday, November 23rd. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Zimbabwe's incoming president returns from exile. Russia takes the lead in talks to end Syria's close to 7-year civil war.
This is all part of the campaign of Vladimir Putin to make Russia again a great and superpower in the world.
A major change could be coming to rules regarding internet use in the United States. Also ahead, millions of Americans are celebrating Thanksgiving. We'll explain what the holiday is all about. It's all on today's International Edition. Russian President Vladimir Putin won the backing of Turkey and Iran on Wednesday to host a Syrian peace conference in the Black Sea resort of Sochi, taking a central role in the diplomatic ending the close of 7 years of civil war that's left hundreds of thousands dead. VOA's Victor Beatty asks Jonathan Adelman, University of Denver professor of international affairs, if this move will undercut the UN Geneva peace process.
Oh, absolutely. Iran is, you know, an authoritarian, radically Islamic state. Russia used to be a communist state, and now it's very authoritarian. And unfortunately, Turkey, which used to be under Kemal Atatürk and his successors, moving towards some version of democracy and some version of capitalism, is also moving in the wrong direction. So if these are the winners, then problems are going to continue to mount in the Middle East.
Will the opposition show up?
Well, the problem is the opposition needs help. And the core problem, for example, the Kurds, and the United States has not been, you know, talks about the Kurds, but and has done some arming of them, but nothing that would compare to dealing with 600,000-man army like the Turks have, or several hundred thousand people and soon nuclear weapons that the Iranians have, and the Russians have 7,000 atomic nuclear bombs. So unfortunately, we haven't really been committed in all of this. And the sad thing is 450,000 people, civilians, have been killed and 25% of population displaced abroad. I mean, this is serious, and we're not paying much attention to it right now.
Israel has warned that a greater Iranian influence will be a danger to the region. Will this situation create basically an opportunity for Iran to deepen its influence in Syria right on the border of Israel?
No, absolutely. And the Russians have refused to say, as the Israelis asked them, to keep that border at least 20 or 30 miles away. They're talking about 3 to 5 miles, which is almost guaranteed. I'll be in Israel in 2 weeks. I've been there 11 times. And the Israelis are just not going to put up with it. They've already attacked about 100 times, reinforcements, sending more modern weapons to Hezbollah. And if this turns out that way, then we're just going to have not the end of war in the Middle East, but don't forget the Saudis. They have been very worried about this, too, and so too have the other Sunni states. So instead of this being the end, this historically will probably be viewed as just the very beginning.
What is the broader objective of Russia in developing this conference and its vision of the Middle East?
They've wanted to come back, whether it is in parts of western Ukraine, whether it's in Crimea, whether it is in Georgia, and now in a victory in Syria. This is all part of the campaign of Vladimir Putin to make Russia again a great and superpower in the world. And so for the Russians, it's easy to understand what they want out of it. And they haven't had much losses, but they've supplied just that margin that the other side needed to win. And even now, they really haven't totally won, but they're going to win at the rate they're going.
The opposition met Wednesday in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. According to a report, they will stick to their demand that Bashar al-Assad go as part of a transition, but they're in a very weakened state. The head of the High Negotiations Committee stepped down just a couple of days before this meeting in Saudi Arabia. The opposition is in a weak position. It's fractured. Should it be demanding that Assad first leave?
I don't think actually the Russians particularly love Assad either, but they want him as a figurehead. And given the fact of 11 million people being murdered, displaced, or actually leaving the country, they'll need him as a symbol. But the reality is that if this new coalition continues, there's going to be some kind of major crisis in the Middle East, because Israel's very small. It's 8,000 square miles. And the Saudis' problem is they don't have a very strong military, and neither does the United Arab Emirates or much of the rest of the Sunni Middle East. So the United States is going to have to make a decision, because because it's been focused on Iranian nuclear weapons, and that's an important issue. But this conventional war that could come up could be extraordinarily violent and really with a lot of spillover into Africa and even parts of southern eastern Mediterranean.
The U.S. has forces on the ground in Syria, of course, helping rebels combat Islamic State, but that fight is nearly over. Diplomatically, the U.S. is nowhere to be found in this peace process.
That's right. We really don't know whether it's because of the new administration or the previous administration, but very clearly what's being missed right now with all, and now even more with scandals, which are a serious issue in American politics, and other things, worrying about the 2018 election, it's almost been pushed off. If you listen to the president today, he gave a list of four or five things that he was concerned about, and he left out Iran. And if you were the Saudis, you would be wondering, what about the alliance between Saudi Arabia and the United States? They can't do it without us.
Well, that's Jonathan Edelman, University of Denver, professor of international affairs. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson calls the violence against Rohingya in Myanmar ethnic cleansing. Bosnians welcome Mladic's conviction, but justice is unlikely to reconcile the divided region. Missing Argentine sub may be running out of air. And the Kremlin vows to defend Russian oligarch who's under arrest in France. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. A former confidant of ousted Zimbabwe leader Robert Mugabe is promising a new unfolding democracy and reaching out to the world for international help rebuilding the country's shattered economy. Zimbabwe's Parliament Speaker said for Vice President Emmerson, Mnangagwa will be sworn in as the country's new president on Friday, taking over following the resignation of Mugabe. Beverly Peters is professor at American University School of Professional and Extended Studies. She tells International Edition's Sarah Williams about Mugabe's history of holding on to power despite controversy.
We saw through his 37 years in power that he was able to consolidate his position time and time again, eliminating opposition, conducting suspect elections, engaging in power-sharing mechanisms that weren't real power-sharing mechanisms, alienating opposition leaders and opposition parties and anybody within ZANU-PF that didn't agree with him.
He took over a country that was known as the breadbasket of Africa, and yet he really drove the economy into the ground.
Absolutely. There's a myriad of different reasons that the Zimbabwe economy is where it is now. I think after the liberation struggle in 1980, things were very positive. And if you go back and look at Robert Mugabe's speeches, he spoke quite eloquently about bringing the population together, working together, building a better Zimbabwe, redressing those colonial imbalances, dealing with land reform. And all of that seemed to fade away within the first decade of his rule. Sure, in 1980, 1985, the country was a breadbasket. It was exporting. The economy was vibrant. But over time, corruption and mismanagement seemed to permeate every layer of the economy, including that land reform program that was so crucial to redress those imbalances that took place during colonialism.
What finally led in this latest crisis that finally led to the fact that there was no way that Mugabe could continue to power?
I think you had a situation where the economy was in a free fall. The economy is devastated. People knew that Mugabe was 93 years old. They knew something else was coming. They knew that there would be some sort of change within that presidency. His move to fire Vice President Mnangagwa was the straw that broke the camel's back, as it were. Analysts felt as if he was placing his wife, Grace Mugabe, in a position to take over as the president in the elections that will come in July or August of next year. And that was really the catalyst that started this soft coup, if you will, and the resignation of Mugabe.
That's Beverly Peters, professor at American University School of Professional and Extended Studies. Kyu Hoang family had her family had everything in Vietnam, or his, I should say. He owned a hotel, had a car, food, and money. But it all changed with the end of the Vietnam War, when he and his family had to flee to the United States. And eventually, he became a billionaire in his new country. As Elizabeth Lee tells us, when devastating floods hit California and Texas this year, Hoang found a way to give back to his new home.
Music has a way of bringing comfort and normalcy. That's the case for retiree Sang Trang and his wife. Floodwaters forced them to flee their home more than 8 months ago.
2 days after the flooding, when the water receded, I came home and found everything damaged. I felt so sorry for myself, as I'm not working anymore, and I do not know how I could afford stuff.
Elizabeth Arredondo and her family were forced out of their home for 2 months.
It made me really sad to think that we no longer had anything.
This entire neighborhood was underwater. Most of the residents who live here are low-income immigrants from Vietnam and Latin America.
14,000 people in San Jose had to evacuate from the flood. But help came when San Jose's mayor received a phone call from Kyu Hoang.
He said, I'm in for $5 million. His mandate was clear and it was perfect. It's exactly what we needed. No strings attached, but every dollar was going to go to the victims, and it did.
Hoang also donated $5 million to flood relief in Houston when Hurricane Harvey hit.
We have to be grateful to the United States of America, to the people who allow us to come into the country to be successful. So now this is the time we pay back.
At the end of the Vietnam War, Hoang and his family fled to Los Angeles as refugees.
In Vietnam, we had everything. I own hotel, I have a car, I have house, things like that. But when I left, I have nothing left. You got it? And so we must do our best in any circumstance or any situation. We have to think how to survive.
Hoang survived on $1.25 an hour, working at Abbott Labs and other odd jobs. Eventually, he founded his own blood plasma company that included 11 centers in the U.S. He expanded into China and built Shanghai RAAS, becoming the company's majority shareholder. But the Chinese blood plasma business has been riddled with controversy. And for Hoang, success came with a price.
In this kind of blood business, we have competition everywhere.
He says his competitors tried to discredit him.
They tried to say, oh, this is our product is bad. This is that China product. So this is the kind of thing I tell you, I hate it.
Hoang says these accusations are wrong and upsetting, so he is focusing on other business ventures and plans to continue helping people like he did in San Jose, where Hoang's donation not only helped flood victims pay for temporary housing.
We also were able to use that funding for car donations, for car repairs, for household items.
Hoang's donation helped Trang buy another car so he can perform his music in his community. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, San Jose.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is Victor Beatty, managing editor of VOA News. Two Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues. As we turn now to what's trending on social media, we hear from VOA's Andrew Palchewski.
Well, the big story today, hashtag net neutrality. The idea of net neutrality is that internet service providers can't charge more money for certain websites or services. And that's actually a policy that was instituted under the Obama administration. But with the Trump administration and the new Federal Communications Commission chairman, Ajit Pai, they have signaled that they would like to repeal that. So it is a big win for internet service providers. They can charge, for instance, more money for people who want to watch faster videos or people who want to access, say, a movie website like Netflix. For a lot of content creators and internet users, this has become a big point of contention. They say it's going to hurt consumers. It's going to cost them more money to get online and use the services that previously have been equal. So we're seeing a lot of talk about that on social media as they plan next month to vote to repeal those regulations. A lot of lobbying on behalf of companies like Netflix, YouTube, other services that allow people to create online content. They'd like to see net neutrality stay in place so that they are not penalized for doing these different services. But that is a big point of talking on conversation on social media today. Of course, the other big story here in the United States is Thanksgiving, and we're seeing a lot of talk on social media about just that, about the traveling, whether it's the traffic on the roads, the lines at the airport, people trying to get from point A to point B with as few delays as possible. And social media has actually become a big asset for a lot of folks checking traffic reports and reports about delays, weather delays, making sure their flights and trains and all other modes of transportation get out on time. But I think later we're going to begin to see that shift. And as people get home, we're going to see a lot more posts about people reuniting with family and friends as they prepare to celebrate tomorrow. And of course, all of the posts about the foods that people are looking forward to. We'll have more about Thanksgiving on the holiday tomorrow. But for right now, the preparation continues, and that's reflected on social media.
All right, Andrew, thank you and happy Thanksgiving. And you can follow Andrew on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, as Andrew said, today is the Thanksgiving holiday here in the United States, a day centered around a big meal and usually with family. The holiday dates back to 1621 when the Plymouth colonists and the Wampanoag Indians shared an autumn harvest feast that's acknowledged today as one of the first Thanksgiving celebrations in the colonies. Nowadays, it's a day to give thanks, enjoy good food and time with family, and it's the start of the Christmas shopping season. VOA's Korean service visited a grocery store just outside Washington to explain how people prepare for the big day. Brian Allen narrates.
More than 50 million Americans are expected to travel during this Thanksgiving, most to spend the holiday with family and friends.
So this year we're going to have our family come in from Morgantown, West Virginia, and Wednesday night my wife flies in from Iceland, so we're going to be cooking all night Wednesday and all early morning Thursday. We're going to have about 11 or 12 kids in our house with four adults, so it's going to be quite a party.
In advance of the holiday, which is celebrated every year on the fourth Thursday of November, grocery stores are crowded with customers stocking up to prepare for the big feast.
So far, just the produce and things like that, so I still need to go and get some of the stuff to make the pies and ingredients for that, so the baking section. Oh, yes, I do not shop close to Thanksgiving. It's too stressful. So many people.
At the center of Thanksgiving dinner is the turkey. 45 million are sold every Thanksgiving season. That is about 18% of annual turkey consumption on one day. Turkey and many of the traditional side dishes on a Thanksgiving menu are sold here at a Wegmans food market.
This is an item that has all your components to Thanksgiving, your stuffing, your butternut squash, your mashed potatoes, your honey brines, roasted turkey, cranberry sauce, everything that you need for one person. So we bump that quantity up to two. as well as three.
According to the American Farm Bureau, the average cost of a turkey dinner for 10 people in the U.S. is just under $50. For VOA's Korean service, Brian Allen, VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
In September 2015, NASA said they had confirmed evidence of liquid water flowing on present-day Mars. The space agency said their Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter identified the chemical signature of hydrated salts and minerals in mysterious dark streaks that are seen flowing down the slopes of a number of Martian hills, mountains, and craters. But a new study suggests that the evidence supporting the existence of water on the Red Planet was misinterpreted. The study proposes that the dark streaks called recurring slope lineae are now understood as being the result of dry, granular flows of sand and dust from recurring avalanches. U.S. Geological Survey scientist and study lead author Colin Dundas says that the new findings suggest that the surface of Mars is quite dry today. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Well, racial inequality in post-war America and civil rights activism are prevalent themes in Hollywood films this season. Using gritty cinematography and A-list actors, directors such as Kathryn Bigelow, George Clooney, and Dan Gilroy shed light on the history of racial injustice in America and open up the conversation about racial tensions in the present. VOA's Penelope Pulu has more.
It's a war zone out there.
The film drama Detroit by Academy Award-winning filmmaker Kathryn Bigelow is based on the 1967 riots that tore apart the city of Detroit.
These riots, this was an anger that was building and was on a collision course in 1967.
Major American cities such as Detroit became the battleground for discontented African Americans facing unemployment and racial discrimination in housing and education. Bigelow focuses on a chain of events one night during the riots that led police to brutalize a group of innocent African Americans.
When I went in there, three kids had been killed.
No. So they were killed right before you got there.
Sir.
You carry a 38, right?
Police officers attempt to incriminate an African-American security guard who witnessed the events at the hotel and tried to intervene to defuse the situation.
I got all night, baby.
John Boyega plays real-life security guard Melvin Dismukes.
I need you to survive the night. He was an unspoken guardian angel to those boys that were there.
Police!
Detroit combines a cinema verite approach with taut drama. Weaving historic footage into dramatic sequences, the film immerses us into the riots as a pivotal moment of systemic racial injustice and repression in America.
My hope is that the film could maybe stimulate greater conversation.
From the inner city, we move to the white American suburbs of the 1950s with George Clooney's dark satire, Suburbicon.
Nothing like this ever happened here.
This is a safe place.
It was.
Like Bigelow, Clooney uses real-life racial tensions as a counterpoint to his murder mystery, which takes place in the all-white suburb of Levittown, Pennsylvania.
I could kill you, too.
A corrupt middle executive played by Matt Damon is getting away with murder while the community focuses its attention and indignation against the Myers, the first African-American family to move into Levittown. George Clooney says when they were making the film, President Donald Trump had not yet been elected, and the racial intolerance that surfaced in Charlottesville had not taken place.
It was in the middle of the campaign, and it seemed like it was fun to talk about and remind people that these are not new subjects.
Mr. Ramirez was told he was not under arrest, and yet he was refused use of the bathroom. That's a violation of civil rights.
You can wait and address.
In Roman J. Israel Esquire, filmmaker Dan Gilroy crafts a character drama that targets institutionalized racism through a corrupt judicial system. The story takes place in today's Los Angeles and revolves around Roman, a socially awkward lawyer.
Okay. Finding contempt.
played by Denzel Washington, Roman comes face to face with an overburdened justice system which disproportionately affects African Americans. Everybody looking at you crazy. Filmmaker Dan Gilroy says his story, like his character, is reminiscent of the political activism of the 1960s and 70s.
The story spoke to me on a very contemporary level. There are things going on right now, legally, constitutionally, nationally and internationally, that the story just became a focus.
Despite their different methodologies, all three films address racial tensions, but also the potential for racial reconciliation and tolerance. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
And finally today, a year of events of marking the 100th anniversary of President John F. Kennedy's birth came to a close on Wednesday. Solemn commemorations came exactly 54 years after Kennedy's assassination in Dallas, Texas, in 1963. Over the past year, numerous conferences and other events have been held worldwide to examine the 35th president's legacy and imagine his impact. Would he have survived? You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for today's show, but find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
On the fourth Thursday in November, Americans celebrate Thanksgiving. The celebration is rooted in the ancient tradition of the Harvest Festival, but in the United States, it has taken a far greater significance. Although there are numerous regional claims as to where the first Thanksgiving was celebrated, the traditional observance stems from a celebration that took place in Massachusetts in November 1621. Those English settlers who celebrated that first Thanksgiving truly did have much for which to be thankful. Known today as the Pilgrims, these Christians were dissenters from the established English church. As part of their religious beliefs, they observed days of fasting and days of thanksgiving in response to events they believed to be special acts of providence. The end of a drought or of a plague might call for a day of thanksgiving. Intent on setting up a community wherein they could live according to their own religious beliefs, they sailed out of England on a ship called the Mayflower in September 1620. 102 would-be colonists and some 30 crew came ashore at Cape Cod on November 9th. Within a year, half of them were dead due to starvation, disease, and the harsh weather conditions of that first winter. But the summer brought a good harvest, and in autumn, 53 pilgrims sat down to a feast with 90 of their neighbors, Wampanoag Indians, who had helped feed and safeguard them over their first year in the New World. Although the holiday had been observed in Virginia since the first permanent colony was founded in Jamestown in 1609, modern Thanksgiving was first officially established in all states in 1863 by a presidential proclamation of Abraham Lincoln. The observance was moved to the fourth week in November by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Thanksgiving began as a prayer of gratitude by immigrants who faced death, who nevertheless came through and endured. Today, for many Americans, it is an occasion for gatherings of family and friends, a day to share a holiday meal with those who matter the most, and a day to give thanks for the many blessings of freedom.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
This is Larry London with more of the world's biggest hits after this news update on VOA 1.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Russia plans to host a Syria Peace Congress to press for a diplomatic solution to the nearly seven-year conflict. Turkey and Iran have pledged to take part. The leaders of the three countries met in the Black Sea resort of Sochi Wednesday, 2 days after President Vladimir Putin of Russia hosted Syria's leader Bashar al-Assad. Mr. Putin said Syrians will determine their own future, but he also acknowledged reform and compromise won't be easy. A date for the meeting hasn't yet been set, but University of Denver International Affairs Professor Jonathan Nadelman said the U.S. is not involved.
Unfortunately, we haven't really been committed in all of this, and the sad thing is 450,000 people, civilians,